This is Valid Talks on Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. It doesn't always work out this way, but primary election day in Pennsylvania, April 26th, might well prove to be significant in the race to the White House, especially for the GOP, for which a contested convention remains a possibility. An estimated 245,000 Pennsylvanians have switched their party registration. We'll talk about what this means. Also, when a voter heads to the booth, what exactly will he or she find on the ballot? Calling the process of choosing Republican delegates convoluted might be too kind. We'll talk about that and the candidates as they begin to target the Keystone State. We'll also try to get to Donald Trump's latest headline-grabbing remarks. And later this hour, we catch up to what's happening regarding the election cycle in New Jersey. But first, we welcome WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies, who also blogs for Newsworks.org. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Mary.
And Chris Borick is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Chris.
So the deadline to register to vote in Pennsylvania's primary was this past Monday. And, you know, people will sometimes switch their party affiliation. As we just said, a couple hundred thousand Pennsylvanians did so. This is obviously an election cycle like none other. So let's start off by talking about what's happening here. Dave Davies, are you surprised? And how do we parse this?
Well, you know, registration always increases in a presidential election year. And for the first time, Pennsylvanians could change their vote registration or register online. So it's easier. And it's true there have been quite a number of switches. Roughly 85,000 Democrats became Republicans. 34,000 Republicans became Democrats. When you net it out, the Republican gain from party switches is a little over 2% of their total registration. So this isn't going to transform the landscape of, you know, the electorate in Pennsylvania. But you do see movement, and there's little doubt that a lot of it has to do with Donald Trump. Mm. I talked to Terry Madonna about this, who does polling at Franklin and Marshall. He says he doesn't have any hard data, but exit polling in other states suggests that most of that is movement to the Republican Party to vote for Trump. That is to say, to support Trump rather than to undermine him. Or if you want to be particularly kind of strategic about it, you might be a Democrat and say, I want to vote for Trump because I think he'll be the weakest candidate in the fall. Most of it appears to be people who are taken with Trump's message and are becoming Republicans to vote for him.
And Chris Borick, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, no, I think Dave's right. You know, one of the things that we see why we would see such activity goes back to one of your first points, Mary, is that we are relevant, or at least appear to be relevant, on both sides of the party divide, with Democrats and Republican races most likely still being vibrant by the time they get here in about a month. And that gives incentive, right? If there's no real race, you'll get a lot of you won't get as nearly as much activity in terms of people switching parties to get in the game. And so this year, a lot of those folks, as Dave said, some of it driven by pro-Trump voters wanting to have the opportunity. And by the way, a lot of those individuals might have been voting Republican for a long time. They've been nominally Democrats, dinos, if you will. And finally, this might be the incentive for them to say, you know what, okay, I have a reason now to want to get in a Republican primary, and it could be Donald Trump.
The other thing that's interesting in the numbers is 52,000 people who were independents or nonpartisan or in other parties switched their registration to become Democrats. And I'm thinking there are probably a lot of voters who are independent-minded who are drawn to Bernie Sanders, and I suspect that's part of what's going on there.
Just for a moment, as an aside, let's just get to the latest headline-grabbing remarks that Donald Trump has made, and that was regarding on MSNBC. Abortion, he was asked whether, if it were outlawed, whether a woman who had an abortion should be punished, and he essentially said yes, and of course a big brouhaha resulted. Do the wheels come off the bus at any point for the Trump, bus?
Haven't found it yet.
No.
I mean, you know, I was amazed when Donald Trump mocked John McCain's war record and then skated away from it. So I don't think we've yet found the Trump gaffe that seems to hurt him. I mean, his numbers are pretty low among women already.
Yeah.
And he has backtracked from this. So I'm guessing it's going to be a one-day news cycle. However, you know, when you get to a general election and you're not one among a big crowd of candidates, but it's a one-on-one affair, and people go back and pull these statements together and put them in 30-second ads. Maybe it'll bite them then.
And Chris, your take?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the rare times, Mary, when I've seen pro-life and pro-choice forces align in anger over one, comment from a candidate. And yeah, the what he said at that point. And Dave is absolutely right. I mean, I don't know how many times I've been wrong in saying this is going to be a fatal blow to Donald Trump, something he said or done, and it's had marginal effect or even boosted his standing. So the pattern says it won't harm him in the end, but it is showing. I mean, I think we've seen a number of these gaffes, if you will, or statements from Trump lately that simply defy any type of reason or political advantage. And he's spending a lot of time on the defensive, walking back comments, explaining away his campaign manager's behaviors. I mean, things that I think even Donald Trump doesn't want to be dealing with as he moves into a key part of the primary season.
Okay, so let's get an illustration of the GOP presidential primary in Pennsylvania. There are 71 delegates at stake, but it is not winner take all. Dave?
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know that there's another state that has a system quite like we do in Pennsylvania. A candidate can win the Pennsylvania Republican primary, win it by 30 points, and lose most of the delegates. And the reason is, of those 71 delegates, the winner of the popular vote statewide gets 17 of them on a winner-take-all basis. That you get. The other 54 delegates, roughly 70% of them, are elected directly by voters, three in each congressional district, and their names appear on the ballot only with the county they come from, not associated with any presidential candidate.
So a voter doesn't know going into the booth who that particular delegate might be supporting.
Nope, you'll see Charlie and Jack and John, and you may recognize a name, you may not, but there will be nothing to indicate whether Charlie supports a particular presidential candidate or is truly uncommitted. They will all be elected as nominally unpledged delegates. So the reality is it will be very hard for voters to tell who they might be helping as they vote for three delegates, or even for those of us on Election Day, on April 26th, to discern clearly which candidate seems to have benefited.
So how does the voter become more informed?
Well, what we think is, what I know is, and I spent some time with this, presidential candidates, when they looked at the rules months ago, realized, my heavens, if we're going to win some of those delegates, we have to recruit our own supporters, very ardent supporters, and get them to agree to run as delegates. And they did this. When I just picked a district, the 15th Congressional District, this big district in western and central Pennsylvania, and I looked up the affidavits and started calling candidates, and I quickly found a Trump person, a very, very committed Trump delegate, a guy who agreed to run as a Trump delegate, another one who was a Cruz delegate, and there are others elsewhere. And so I know their names, but if they are going to help their candidate, what's going to have to happen is that those presidential campaigns that Trump and Cruz, and to the extent they have candidates, the Kasich campaign, are going to have to find ways to tell voters. They'll do it through email blasts, through social media, and to the extent they can manage it, putting a field team out at polling places with those little sample ballots that saying, if you want to help Ted Cruz, vote for this person. It's a real challenge, and nobody quite knows how it's going to play out.
Mm. Let's get back to the popular vote. Chris Borick, what do you think the backlash would be like if, say, Donald Trump or, you know, John Kasich won the popular vote, but delegates went another way?
Oh, I think it'll be enormous, Mary, in the sense that you'll get a reaction from Trump supporters that this race has been stolen from them. I mean, the concepts, as Dave described, in Pennsylvania's in particular, we have the most baroque, confusing system for selecting delegates, and the process as a whole is layered and confusing and not very transparent. So you'll get a sense, you know, the most reasonable expectation is, well, my candidate got the most votes, the most delegates, they should win. Well, that's not how it always works. In fact, regularly it doesn't work when we design electoral systems to reward other things like delegate choice or delegate preferences or state numbers from an electoral college. And so, yeah, the reaction is going to be visceral and negative and anger if that happened. And, you know, what those voters do, these people that we've talked about earlier and Dave mentioned that might be coming in for Donald Trump in terms of their actions electorally after a decision like that would be very likely to be either walking away from the Republican Party, walking away from the system, or you know, simply staying home.
Dave Davies, if I were a Pennsylvania resident, I might be asking, why is it this complicated, and who set this up?
Yeah, and let's emphasize, this is the Republican side of the primary.
Right.
The Democrats is more reflective of what the popular vote will be. I wondered this, and I developed a theory, and I think I'm right. I checked it with some old party leaders. This system has been around for a long time, and it stems from the fact that the Pennsylvania primary comes late in the cycle, usually doesn't matter. And if you think about what happens when you go and vote for any office in which most people don't know the candidates, most people don't vote. And so they tend to be elected by whoever can get a field operation out at the polling place handing out sample ballots. They won't get most voters, but you don't need that many because nobody knows who the candidates are. Well, who typically does that in any primary election? The county Republican or Democratic organizations. They're used to fielding an operation for every election. And I think the party leader said, well, if we do it this way, and if we let the people file and delegates appear on the ballot with no identification, what will actually happen is that the mainstream county Republican organizations will field slates and they will win because they're used to getting people out recommending candidates to voters. And what you will end up with is a big block of 54 or most of 54 delegates who are party regulars who will listen to party leaders when it's time to make a tough decision. And what that means is Pennsylvania comes into a convention with some leverage, a bunch of uncommitted delegates who they can influence to go one way or another. Now, when I've talked to individual delegates who are, in fact, county party regulars, they're troubled by all of this. And some of them tell me, well, I'm going to cast my vote for whichever candidate wins my neighborhood or my community or my congressional district. They are very sensitive to the fact that they could be perceived as overruling the popular will. So it's not exactly clear how it's going to play out in this crazy year. But I think that was what it was designed to do, to create a delegation that had a lot of flexibility and leverage that could be influenced by party leaders.
Chris Bork, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, Dave's right. I mean, these are ultimately party elections, right? These are the goal is to have the party represented in the way that the party wants. It doesn't come to the same standards as we might think for a general election and how we might design it. And every state has powers. Pennsylvania, as Dave said, I think he's absolutely right, has tried to empower the people that are running the party to have the biggest say. And that's exactly where we're at this particular cycle.
All right, Chris Bork is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College. Dave Davies, WHYY senior reporter. We're back after the break. If you'd like to join the conversation, lines are open, 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes at whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. This is Ballot Talks today, and the Pennsylvania primary is our focus at the moment. Our guests for this segment include Chris Bork, professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Also, Dave Davies is WHYY's senior reporter, and he also blogs for Newsworks.org. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes at whyy.org. Or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And also, before I forget, throughout the month of April, in advance of the Pennsylvania primary, Marty Moscowane will be interviewing candidates for the state's major offices, so be sure to tune in for that. So let's start this segment by talking about the race for the U.S. Senate seat held by Republican Pat Toomey, who is running for re-election. Katie McGinty, a Democrat, has been endorsed by President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. Joe Sestak, her main rival in the Democratic primary, is leading in the poll. So, Chris Bork, what do these endorsements do for Katie McGinty, if anything?
Yeah, I think it's good news for Katie McGinty. As you said, some of the early polls have Joe Sestak leading, but an enormous group of Democrats undecided at this point in the race. I don't think the electorate has been very tuned into the race. The ads are just starting to come up. And having Joe Biden and, more importantly, Barack Obama come on record and endorse you among a Democratic primary electorate is major. It's very helpful to have those voices speak for you. The president is extremely popular among Democrats in the state, in our polling and other polling, and having that on record is a great benefit for you. You know, the opponents are going to, of course, spin it in the direction, well, it's just the establishment coming in on the side of the establishment candidate, and in this particular year, that certainly isn't a badge of honor. But it's hard, and I, you know, in the statements from Joe Sestak and John Fetterman, McGinty's opponents, about the president's endorsements, they were careful not to say anything negative, particularly about the president, just that she has the establishment backing, and that's the best they could do. I think it's a big benefit for her.
And also, interestingly, Chris, I read this morning that the president has endorsed Josh Shapiro running on the Democratic side for Pennsylvania State Attorney General. Is this unusual?
Yeah, you usually don't see presidents getting involved in what might be called lower-level races now. The PA Attorney General race is important in the state, but maybe not on the national landscape, or doesn't have any effect in Washington politics, per se. But another big benefit, if you remember 4 years ago, Bill Clinton endorsed Kathleen Kane, and that was a big boost to her in getting her state recognition, and those ads, I think, were powerful as part of her narrative as she ran for office. And I think it's the same for Shapiro, to have a popular party leader and president of the United States backing you at this level. Again, the charges will be that he's the establishment candidate, and that's just this is an artifact of that. But it's extremely helpful for him, as he's in a very competitive race for this seat.
Yeah, and Josh Shapiro, I think partly that is a personal relationship. Back in 2008, when Josh Shapiro was a leader in the legislature and Barack Obama was a senator running for president, Shapiro endorsed him early, campaigned with him, and I think there's a personal relationship that matters there. You know, very few endorsements move a lot of votes by themselves, and I think one of the interesting unanswered questions is exactly what Barack Obama is going to do for these candidates. If he makes a personal appearance with Katie McGinty or headlines a fundraiser or tells his big donors to give to her or records a radio ad that would run, say, on African-American radio stations in Philadelphia, that's a way of really giving some impact to that support.
Let's look again to the GOP side of the U.S. Senate race. If Donald Trump were to end up the GOP nominee, what does this mean for incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey? Dave?
It's not good. I mean, you know, when the state Republican Party invited Donald Trump as its keynote speaker for a fundraising luncheon in New York, Pat Toomey did not attend. And he and other moderate Republicans have signaled, sometimes clearly and sometimes indirectly, that Trump would be a disaster for people at the bottom of farther down the ticket. And so I think it's a terrible, terrible problem for them. And one of the interesting things we're seeing in the party is those who want to stop Trump, how do they do they back Ted Cruz, who, you know, moderates don't particularly warm to and doesn't particularly develop warm and fuzzy feelings among other politicians, or do they go with Kasich, who's so far behind, it's harder to make a case for him getting the nomination? It's a real dilemma for them.
So, Chris Borick, Toomey had endorsed Marco Rubio. Has he indicated his second choice?
No, I think Dave laid it out. It's a really difficult choice for him. Obviously, Donald Trump poses a lot of problems, potentially, as Dave noted, for down ballot Republicans in a place like Pennsylvania, and particularly for Pat Toomey. It's interesting, you know, you look at Senator Toomey's background. He was a leader with the Club for Growth, a Republican PAC interest group that is one of the biggest and staunchest opponents of Donald Trump. So you could see the tenuous relationship that they would have moving forward. And his decisions on this are difficult. I mean, he's got a big difficult choice. If Donald Trump is, do you back your party nominee? Do you distance yourself? Do you remain rather silent on it? All the choices aren't particularly good for Pat Toomey. And then you layer in just the electoral problem for Republicans in presidential years in Pennsylvania. It's a different electorate. Pat Toomey got elected in 2010, one of the best environments ever for a Republican running for statewide office. Democrats didn't show up. Republicans were energized with the Tea Party movement. And now he's in a situation where he's going to face an electorate that's almost undoubtedly going to be less favorable to him. Throw in Trump, it's a problem for Senator Toomey.
You know, one specific way that this will play out in a way that's not helpful to Toomey in the fall, if Trump is the nominee, Democrats are already pointing out, you know, that Pat Toomey has joined in other Republican leaders in refusing to consider President Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
Yes.
And so in the fall, what they've already been saying, and what they'll be saying in the fall is, so, Senator Toomey, you want Donald Trump's nominee for Supreme Court. Don't you? Isn't that, in effect, what you're asking us to do, is to let Donald Trump nominate our next Supreme Court justice? And that's a question Pat Toomey doesn't want to have to answer.
Now, Toomey has said he will meet with Merrick Garland, the Supreme Court nominee, out of courtesy to President Obama. At the same time, he still believes the vacancy on the Supreme Court shouldn't be filled this year. Does this hurt him at the polls?
We'll see. I mean, I think the fact that he met with the nominee is an indication that he's concerned about the impact of this. I don't know. I'm of two minds about this. Partly, I sort of see it as roughly analogous to the Republican-engineered shutdown of the government back in the early 90s, which sort of reversed Republican gains in Congress and which revived Democratic President Bill Clinton, because people were seen as putting their partisan interests above running the country, doing their jobs. And it seems to me you can make a similar kind of argument here about, you know, your job is to, in fact, advise and consent, confirm Supreme Court nominees. On the other hand, you know, by the fall, will it still be as meaningful an issue that far from the nomination? I just don't know. But if I were Pat Toomey, I'd be thinking about it.
Mm. Chris Bork, let's take a look at political ads being aired in Pennsylvania in advance of the primary. Are there some that stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, you could see some of the Senate races, as we mentioned before. They're starting to come up with ads, especially on the Democratic side where the competition is. And you could see some of the patterns where the candidates are going to perceive strengths. Katie McGinty's ads stressing the disparate wage gap between men and women in terms of earnings. The Democratic electorate is a large majority are women. This is an issue that has always resonated with women voters in the state and beyond. And it's an interesting, I think, a reminder. Pennsylvania has a very poor record in terms of electing women to office. Not one of our 18 members of the congressional delegation is a woman. We've never elected a woman to the U.S. Senate or governor. I think bringing this issue up in various ways is beneficial to Katie McGinty. You see the ads from Joe Sestak going back to his military background. He's picked up on the "I've got your six" adage that's been used by the military in terms of basically "I got your back," and trying to, I think, parlay that strength and his background there. So you see candidates going early, and these are positive ads again, emphasizing some of their perceived strengths moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to just one more question about TV ads before we get to some online comments. Dave, Dwight Evans, state representative, is airing the first TV ad for the second congressional district. It's expensive to do this, and he's up against incumbent Chaka Fatah. It's expensive to do this, hundreds of thousands of dollars, I've read. So what does this get you on television in the age of the internet? How does this move a candidate forward?
Well, you know, political advertising is evolving, but I think the pros will still tell you that the greatest single predictor of who votes is not race or party or education or income, it's age. Older people still are the most reliable voters, and they still watch Jeopardy. And so I think people believe that there is still value in commercial TV buys, and that's incredibly expensive, as you note, in this market, where in the case of Dwight Evans, he is most of the people seeing those ads cannot vote for him because he's targeting voters in a particular congressional district. Sure. And so, you know, you try and target it with cable buys and direct mail, and people are getting increasingly sophisticated in internet ads that will pop up when you watch a YouTube video. So we'll see more of that. But that's what he's up to.
All right. To the comments we go. We have a tweet from NASA who asks, if I vote for a Democratic delegate, how do I know how they will vote at the convention? Chris Borick?
Well, that is a little simpler than on the Republican side. The delegates are apportioned based on proportionality of the votes. So let's say Hillary Clinton got 70% of the votes in Pennsylvania. She's going to get roughly 70% of the delegates that are bound to vote for her at the convention in Philadelphia. So it's a fairly direct relationship where if you vote for a candidate on the Democratic side, it's going to roughly translate into a vote for that candidate at the convention.
Yeah, just to add to that, you will see on the ballot on the Democratic ballot April 26th. The delegate candidates, and it will be clear which presidential candidate they are for. If you vote for all of them or none of them, it won't affect the number of delegates that Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders get. That they're going to be apportioned delegates based upon their performance in congressional districts and the statewide vote. It's a little complicated, but roughly they're going to get proportionally what they deserve. What your vote for particular delegates will affect is actually who goes to the convention. Bernie Sanders will have a slate of 14 delegates in the second congressional district, and if by virtue of the popular vote he ends up getting seven of them, then the top seven Sanders delegate candidates will go to the convention and the other seven will watch it on TV. That's what it affects. It's the popular presidential vote that will really determine how much support they get at the convention in Philadelphia.
And we have an email from Paul. He says, is there any consensus among your guests about which challenger would be most likely to carry the general election for the Senate seat? Dave, care to jump in on that?
No, I don't think there's a consensus about that. Joe Sestak barely lost to Pat Toomey 6 years ago. Some people say Katie McGinty is exactly what you need. She's a woman in a year in which Hillary Clinton is likely to head the ballot and women voters will be energized. And then John Fetterman, the utterly unique mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania, who kind of brings his own experience with income inequality and trying to revive a blighted community there. Certainly a unique style and a unique message. And the state chairman of the Democratic Party, Marcel Groen, said in an editorial interview he thought Fetterman might be the strongest against Toomey. I think you can make a case for any of them.
Chris Borick?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I don't think there is a clear consensus. I think you see party leaders clearly favoring Kathleen McGinty. I think they think she is the type of candidate that they'd be very comfortable putting up. Joe Sestak, as Dave said, performed really well. And again, back to 2010, not a good year to be running as a Democrat in a Senate race. So I think Sestak, who is a tireless worker, is a hard campaigner, could bring his own gifts. And John Fetterman, as Dave said, is an absolutely unique candidate as the mayor of Braddock, and his personality and his approach might be, in a year of outsiders, the classic fit.
Yeah, and I'll just quickly note, party leaders have united around Katie McGinty in large part because they cannot stand Joe Sestak. I mean, they resent the fact that he ran against their anointed nominee, Arlen Specter, 6 years ago, and they believe he cost them a Senate seat and a House seat, and he just goes his own way. He's not somebody who's going to listen to them when they try and give him the word.
All right, let's try to get a phone call in before the break. Peter in Wyomissing, you're live on Radio Times. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello?
Hello, yes, we can. You're on the air. What's your question, Peter?
Sorry about that. My observation is just to follow up. My understanding is that part of the reason Sestak is being attacked is that back when he was running, Chuck Schumer, who heads up the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, which funds a lot of campaigns, basically said, you will have someone that we will give you for a legislative assistant who will tell you how to vote. Do you agree? And he said no. Now, this may or may not be true, but I think it also shows perhaps that there's some bad blood between specifically Ed Rendell, who's former head of the DNC, because this is a primary.
Peter, we only have a few seconds, so let me just stop you right there. Chris, what do you think?
No, I think he's right. And Dave was right, too. There's no love lost between Democratic leaders and Joe Sestak. The relationship is clearly strained, and the party has never felt very comfortable with him. And it's an issue that I think they've dealt with for a while, and if Joe Sestak is successful, they're going to have to deal with it for a longer time this fall.
And Peter, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. So Pennsylvania Times has been considered a swing state. What color is it these days, Dave?
It's so funny, isn't it? I mean, it's you know, it's got a solidly Republican legislature and a solidly Republican congressional delegation. You can make an argument that that's a lot of that's gerrymandering. And yet it hasn't voted for a Republican presidential candidate since 1988. So there you are.
And Chris, what's your thought?
It's hard to call a swing state when it doesn't swing, Mary.
Yeah.
It, as they said, has been since 1988. There's many characteristics of the state that Republicans do very well. Presidential races have not been one of those. And I've heard the term fool's gold thrown out for Republicans a number of times, that it looks attractive. It looks like the place where Republicans might be able to win a presidential race, but they don't. And so it'll be interesting, obviously, with candidate choice on the GOP side this year to see just how attractive it is as a place for Republican candidates to play this fall.
All right, that about wraps up our look for the moment at the Pennsylvania primary. Chris Borick, our thanks to you. Chris is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College. And Dave Davies, thank you so much for joining
us. Good to be
here,
Mary.
Studio. Dave is WHYY's senior reporter and blogger for Newsworks.org. Up next, New Jersey's primary is June 7th. We'll take a look at some of the races there and talk about delegates with Ben Dworkin of Rider University. Stay with us. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. And we wrap up the hour by jumping across the Delaware River to New Jersey. It's a big year in the Garden State with elections in all 12 congressional districts. There are also some significant ballot questions to talk about. And, of course, there are the candidates vying for president. New Jersey's primary is June 7th. If you have questions or comments, feel free to give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And joining us now to offer his analysis is Ben Dworkin, director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics at Rider University. Ben is also adjunct assistant professor of political science at Rider. Ben Dworkin, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mary. I'm glad to be here.
So this election cycle, Ben, has been such an anomaly. Earlier in the show, we discussed the role Pennsylvania's primary might play in the nomination of the Republican candidate for president. New Jersey's primary election day is late, but still, in your opinion, might New Jersey's primary election carry some weight in the nomination process, particularly for Republicans?
It might, because the races for the presidency, for the nomination, are not yet won on either side, on the Democratic side or the Republican side, and because New Jersey is still a relatively big state. The fact that people are competing this far, this late into the primary season, means that New Jersey, for the first time in a while, might have some real clout in determining who wins in the end.
Do you think, though, by the time we get to early June, the Democratic side will be pretty much sealed?
It should be, but we'll... Again, this is a year in which people in my profession who look at this stuff and study it have continually been stunned by how the conventional wisdom and historical trends no longer hold. And I'll just give a quick example. With Donald Trump, you know, you're not supposed to get away with insulting a PO, a person like John McCain, who served for years as a prisoner of war, you're not supposed to be getting away with politically with insulting him, and yet he does. So all the sort of the rules about what should be done, when it should be over, are a little bit up in the air. Yes, on the Democratic side, Hillary should, by that time, capture the votes that she needs in order to win. And on the Republican side, you know, it's so topsy-turvy. We'll have to see what happens in the next few weeks, because obviously there's some key states that are coming up beforehand.
Ben, earlier this hour, we did talk about Donald Trump's remarks regarding abortion on MSNBC yesterday. He managed to offend somehow both pro-life and pro-choice camps by saying that if abortion were to be outlawed, women should be punished who've had abortions. Women who've had abortions should be punished. And he quickly backtracked on that. But does this stick to him in a negative way?
I think it reinforces concerns that people who are not full-throated Trump voters have. A person who is backing Trump doesn't care what he has to say. They're looking for someone who's strong. They're looking for someone who's a winner and someone who talks in a way that connects with them. And given all the other things that he's said, I don't think these particular comments are going to suddenly make the Trump supporter not be a Trump supporter. Where it affects him is clearly with independents, with people. It affects him for the, not in the primary season, but much more if he wins the nomination in the general election in November 2016. And it's, even though he backtracked it, you're just going to see continued efforts by Democrats to link every Republican candidate to Donald Trump. He is the leader of your party. Do you agree or disagree? This, you know, Republican candidate for Congress in Pennsylvania or New Jersey is running on the same ticket with Donald Trump. Here's a picture of the two of them at the Republican convention. You know, voting for one is like voting for the other. I think that's the kind of political strategy that is, first of all, pretty obvious. And, you know, if these things were happening on the Democratic side, I'm sure Republicans would do it too. But you got to expect Democratic political operatives to be looking for those opportunities. Every time Trump says something controversial, even if he walks it back like he did the comments on abortion, it's really just one more opportunity to hurt the Republican brand, to link other Republican candidates with him, or force them to spend time and effort distancing themselves.
So, Ben Dworkin, as I mentioned earlier, all 12 congressional seats are up for grabs in New Jersey, or up, you know, the focus of elections. Is there a great biting of fingernails from Republican incumbents regarding the potential of a Donald Trump candidacy as a nominee?
Not in New Jersey, not particularly. And not because people aren't worried, but I think there are still many Republicans here in the state who aren't quite convinced that Trump will actually get the nomination. You know, if he is unable to come to Cleveland, where the Republicans are having their convention, with the required number of votes, then after the first ballot, in which nobody wins the required votes, the whole thing might, you know, be up for grabs, and there's any number of different scenarios. And so I think people are sort of holding off on real biting of the nails. I'm sure there's private fretting, but publicly, nobody's quite there yet. And obviously, the governor has become a full-throated supporter of Trump. So he provides a certain amount of political cover for others to do the same.
Earlier this hour, we did talk about how Pennsylvania's delegates are chosen. So again, for New Jersey, 51 delegates go to the Republican convention, 142 to the Democratic gathering. Am I correct?
Yes.
All right. So the Republican side first, how does the process compare to that of Pennsylvania? And how about then the Democrats?
Well, I can't speak to Pennsylvania, but so the process in New Jersey is that it's a winner-take-all Republican primary. So whoever wins statewide gets all 51 Republican delegates. On the Democratic side, the rules are different, and it's proportional. But it's not proportional statewide. Effectively, the state is divided for the primary into 20 districts, each with about 440,000 people each. In each of these districts, there is a proportional allocation of the delegates. So how many delegates does District 1 or District 2 out of these 20 gets? That depends on how many Democrats have come out in past years. They allocate a certain number each side. Say Sanders and Clinton will have their delegate lists. And if they split 50-50 in that district of 440,000 people, then they will split the delegates. So it becomes a proportional per district. If one person, if Hillary Clinton overwhelmingly wins a particular district by 80-90%, let us say, then she'll win all of the delegates from that district. So it's proportional, but it's not proportional on a statewide vote. It's proportional depending on which of these districts you're in.
All right, let's go to the phones. Bill in Belmont Hills, welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about superdelegates in the Democratic Party, and I'll explain that. If you're a Democrat anywhere in the country, you and many other people all together elect each delegate through caucuses and primaries. But if you're a superdelegate, who's usually a Democratic Party official or a high-level elected official, then you get your very own vote at the convention for a candidate. And this is really a bad system. It's unnecessary, and it's one of the few instances where the Republican system is actually better than the one we Democrats have. This election cycle stacks the deck in favor of Hillary, regardless of how many contests that Bernie wins. So I'd appreciate your thoughts about this.
And Dworkin?
Sure. Look, these things have developed over time. After 1968 and heading into 1972, the Democrats greatly opened the process in order to allow real voters, not just party officials, to have more of a say in who votes. And that has given huge opportunity to people who are not necessarily favored by everybody on the insiders level. And what they found is that a political party is a balance between both the grassroots and the elected leadership and the elites. And so they came up with this compromise as a reaction to having so many open primaries. They decided to create the superdelegate system, which, as Bill mentioned, are largely elected officials, governors, members of Congress, senators, etc. They do have their own vote. They are not automatically pledged to one candidate. They obviously decide. And so if you go back to 2008, when you had Barack Obama challenging the institutional, the favorite of Hillary Clinton, he was able to overcome whatever it already sort of superdelegate support that she was able to find. Obviously, it didn't make a difference. So I think we just need to understand, people continue to debate this. There are folks like Bill, the caller, who will say this is just a bad system.
Sure.
There are others who find that it helps provide a little bit of balance. And it's going to be a continuing debate in the Democratic Party, certainly going forward. But I think it's important to remember 2008 being a good example. Just because you have a large support among superdelegates doesn't mean you automatically win.
Bill, thank you for the call to Radio Times. To Flemington, New Jersey, we go. And David, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you both. I believe it's a public misconception that who represents a party as a presidential candidate is the right of the public to be involved in. I think essentially it is a private party matter, and they can extend the privilege of involving us. But in terms of super delegates or contested conventions, they don't even in the first place have to involve the public in who they run. And I think a lot of the discontent about all of these issues involving who's going to be their choice is misfounded. Could your guest please address that?
Sure. Thanks, David, for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. political parties are unique entities, and they have a couple different ways of you can think about them. There is the party in the electorate, and that's, you know, the brand, the Republican brand, the Democratic brand. It is how the masses of people either identify with a party or don't. In the end, when you have national elections, you need people to support you. So even though you have another aspect of the party, which is sort of the party in government, the people who are running. We think of Paul Ryan as representing the Republican Party because he's the Speaker of the House, or Mitch McConnell, the President of the United States Senate. These are the Republican Party. But they are one aspect of the Republican Party. There's the party in the government. There's party in the electorate. These are all have to come together. And so while David is correct in that these are effectively private entities, they create their own rules for who's allowed to be a member, who they can kick out, who gets to who is eligible to vote, to be an to be nominated. These are but it's a conglomeration of different forces. And part of it, because we live in a representative democracy, involves extending the party, opening the party on either side to the public so that they can be involved. And, you know, this is, we have seen various levels of involvement and counteractions to that involvement. But nonetheless, it's sort of a, it's a combination of all these forces, even if it's a technically a private entity.
Just have a few moments left here, and I wanted to get to at least one question on the ballot. One will ask whether the construction of casinos should be allowed outside Atlantic City, specifically in North Jersey at the Meadowlands Racetrack in Jersey City. Considering the saturation of the market in the Northeast, the casino market, the financial crisis in AC, the warning from Moody's Investor Service that such a move would likely further destabilize Atlantic City. Where do you think this will go?
It's going to be very difficult to sort of predict right now. There are a couple things going on here. First of all, the idea is that by establishing North Jersey casinos, you can compete with the potential of a New York City casino. That is the great fear, that New York City will effectively take all of northern New Jersey in terms of casinos. You already have a nice place out in Yonkers, but they're going to build something bigger potentially, and therefore you need North Jersey casinos established now to compete. It may or may not pass. I mean, the North, the New York City gaming interests are going to put millions of dollars into fighting this thing.
But there's a lot of support among Governor Christie and interests,
South. Right, because so first of all, New Jersey, many New Jersey politicians want to see it because it's jobs, because they think it's billions of dollars in new development and ancillary development. They think it puts them in a better competitive standing, and the idea is that a large percentage, upwards of 50%, 35 to 50% of the take of these North Jersey casinos will be funneled back in to the South Jersey casinos. And it will be funneled back into supporting Atlantic City.
I don't think they're buying it in South Jersey.
They're not. you know, I think intuitively people see competition as competition.
Yep.
And so it's going to, like I said, that's in November. It's on the ballot. I think both sides are going to spend millions of dollars trying to convince the public. And it's, I think, a little too early to predict how it's all going to play out.
We shall see. Ben Dworkin, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Mary. I appreciate the time.
Ben is director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics at Rider University and adjunct assistant professor of political science at Rider. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcast. Just head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.